From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Nick Hornby talks about his new novel, How to Be Good. He's best known for his novel, High Fidelity, about a guy obsessed with pop music, and Fever Pitch, a memoir about Hornby's obsession with soccer. Also, David Haydu talks about his new book, Positively 4th Street, about the new folk music of the 60s and the interconnected stories of Bob Dylan, Joan Baez, her sister Mimi Farina, and Mimi's husband Richard. And Milo Miles reviews White African, the new CD by blues musician and singer Otis Taylor. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. The White House now says President Bush will not ask for a regulation exempting religious charities from laws that prohibit discrimination against gays. Aides say the White House had reviewed a request by the Salvation Army to allow it and other faith-based charities to keep their ban on hiring homosexuals. Administration officials said today that language in the president's proposed faith-based initiative already protects religious charities from hiring people who don't share their views. Israel's army has demolished some 24 homes and shops at a Gaza refugee camp, making one of the heaviest gun battles in weeks. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports.
Army bulldozers moved into the Rafah camp near Egypt's border after midnight. The army said it tore down homes that were empty and being used by Palestinian snipers to fire at Israeli troops. But Palestinian families told of frantically fleeing their homes in their pajamas, grabbing children and whatever they could salvage. Israel says Palestinian militants hurled grenades at the bulldozers in a two-hour clash. Palestinians charged that the bulldozers invaded Palestinian-ruled territory, but Israel's army said it had security control in the area. Yesterday, Israel also tore down a dozen Palestinian homes in East Jerusalem, saying they were built without permits. It was the largest such demolition in months. Human rights groups called the destruction provocative. They worry it could further undermine efforts to enforce a U.S.-brokered ceasefire. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Jerusalem.
The jury in New York has once again split on whether to give the death penalty to a terrorist convicted in the 1998 U.S. bombings in Africa. Instead, Khalfan Mohammed will get life behind bars. The same jury spared the life of another defendant in the case last month. The two embassy bombings killed 224 people. A Florida judge has issued a final order barring a student newspaper and a website from viewing the autopsy photos of race car driver Dale Earnhardt. From member station WMFE, Joshua Azrael has the story.
Volusia County Circuit Judge Joseph Will upheld the constitutionality of a new state law, barring access to autopsy photos without a court order. His order confirms a ruling he made last month after hearing 3 days of testimony. Although the website has no plans to appeal, the attorney for the college student-run newspaper in Gainesville says he will file a motion for a new trial and appeal the judge's decision if the motion is denied. The judge's ruling, however, does leave the door open for other media outlets to file a motion to view the autopsy photos on a case-by-case basis. The Orlando Sentinel and the South Florida Sun Sentinel are challenging the new law in a separate case in a Broward County court. Dale Earnhardt died February 18th on the last lap of the Daytona 500. For NPR News, I'm Joshua Azrael in Orlando.
Compaq Computer Corporation said today it will cut 4,000 more jobs. That will bring this year's total to 8,500. On Wall Street, the Dow was down 123 points. The Nasdaq fell 64. This is NPR News. The Postal Service has decided to drop a proposal that would have eliminated Saturday delivery. The plan was dropped in the face of heavy criticism from the public and Congress. The agency is looking to offset huge losses expected this year. The Postal Service has halted most construction and made other cuts to ease the losses caused by a shrinking economy and rising gas prices. The best players in Major League Baseball are gathered in Seattle for tonight's All-Star Game. Long described as baseball's midsummer classic, the game has been attracting fewer fans in recent years. NPR's Tom Goldman reports.
The All-Star Game provides a snapshot of the first half of the season. Longtime Japanese batting champion Ichiro Suzuki has been the story of the year in baseball. The hot-hitting outfielder for the Seattle Mariners is the leadoff batter for the American League. The Mariners come into the All-Star Game with the best record in baseball. Not surprisingly, 8 Seattle players are on the American League roster, the most from one team in the last 41 years. Veterans Cal Ripken and Tony Gwynn will make their final All-Star appearances. They both announced they'll retire at the end of the season. Baseball officials hope the storylines are enough to halt the recent slide in All-Star Game TV ratings. For reasons that include a lack of competitiveness in the game and some star players saying they'd rather not take part, ratings have dropped in the last decade, with last year's the lowest ever. Tom Goldman, NPR News.
The army is out in force in the Jamaican capital. The government's trying to stem violence that killed more than 20 people this week. Soldiers are using trucks and armored cars to reinforce police who've been battling opposition party supporters in the capital of Kingston. I'm Frank Stacio, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for National Public Radio comes from Rockefeller Brothers Fund, providing support for NPR cultural programming through a Charles E. Culpepper Endowment Grant.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Nick Hornby, is best known for his novel High Fidelity, about a guy who owns a used record store and defines himself and everyone he meets by their taste in music. John Cusack starred in the movie adaptation. Hornby writes about pop music for The New Yorker. He's also the author of the novel About a Boy and the memoir Fever Pitch about his obsession with soccer, or football as it's called in England, where he lives. Last year, Hornby edited an anthology of short stories with profits going to the special school that his autistic son attends. Hornby has a new novel called How to Be Good. It's written from the point of view of a woman who has been married for 24 years. On the first page of the novel, she surprises herself by telling her husband she wants a divorce. She's a doctor who works in a clinic. Her husband David stays home, takes care of their two kids, and writes a local newspaper column called The Angriest Man in Holloway, illustrated with a picture of him snarling at the camera. The cynical persona he adapts for his column is not far from who he is, and she's tired of the negativity, the bickering, and the feeling that he just doesn't like her anymore. Here's a reading.
What did I think I was choosing when I married David? What do any of us think we're choosing? If I tried to recapture now the semi-formed fantasies I had then, I'd say they erred on the side of prosperity and health, rather than anything very difficult. I thought, I suppose, that we'd be poor but happy to begin with, meaning that we would be living in a small, cute flat and spending a lot of time watching TV or drinking halves of beer in pubs and making do with our parents' hand-me-down furniture. In other words, the difficulties I was prepared to tolerate in the early years of my marriage were essentially romantic in their nature, inspired by the clichés of young married life as depicted in TV comedies. Or, possibly, given that most TV comedies are more sophisticated and complex than my fantasies, by building society advertisements. Then, later on, I thought, one set of difficulties, the difficulties posed by watching TV in a small flat and by eating baked beans on toast, would be replaced by another, the difficulties that arose when you had two lovely, bright and healthy children. There would be muddy football boots and teenage daughters hogging the phone and husbands who had to be torn from the TV to do the washing up. Golly gosh, there'd be no end to these sorts of problems, and I was under no illusions. Muddy football boots would be awfully trying. I was prepared, though. I wasn't green. I wasn't born yesterday. There was no way I was ever going to buy white rugs. What you don't ever catch a glimpse of on your wedding day, because how could you? Is that some days you will hate your spouse, that you will look at him and regret ever exchanging a word with him, let alone a ring and bodily fluids. Nor is it possible to foresee the desperation and depression, the sense that your life is over, the occasional urge to hit your whining children, even though hitting them is something you knew for a fact that you would never do. And, of course, you don't think about having affairs, and when you get to that stage in life, when you do, and everyone gets there sooner or later, you don't think of the sick feeling you get in your stomach when you're conducting them, their inherent unhappiness. And nor do you think about your husband waking up in the morning and being someone you don't recognize. If anyone thought about any of these things, then no one would ever get married. Of course they wouldn't. In fact, the impulse to marry would come from the same place as the impulse to drink a bottle of bleach, and those are the kinds of impulses we try to ignore rather than celebrate. So, we can't afford to think about these things because getting married or finding a partner whom we want to spend our lives with and have children by is on our agenda. It's something we know we will do one day, and if you take that away from us, then we're left with promotions at work and the possibility of a winning lottery ticket, and it's not enough. So we kid ourselves that it is possible to enter these partnerships and be faced only with the problems of mud removal. And then we become unhappy and take Prozac, and then we get divorced and die alone.
Nick Hornby, thanks for reading that. And that's a passage from Nick Hornby's new novel, How to Be Good. It's never really clear to me that the couples in your books are particularly well-matched in the first place.
Probably where I go wrong.
They seem to fight a lot right from the beginning. And also, in your typical couple in your books, the guy seems to have this obsession with something, soccer, music, you know, records, and the woman seems to be a much more kind of practical, down-to-earth type of person, and they complement each other but don't quite understand each other.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough. I don't ever quite understand what it means to be well matched as a couple, because you can both share a passionate interest in pedigree dogs and nothing else is going right for you at all. There are all sorts of ways in which we don't match up, and that could be temperamentally or in terms of our ambition, in terms of our lifestyles. There are just probably too many things that can go wrong for that ever to make sense, I think, the idea that we're looking for a perfect mate.
The woman in your novel has an affair with somebody else as her relationship with her husband is going bad. And I think you capture something here. She says, what I really want and what I'm not getting with my husband is the opportunity to rebuild myself from scratch. My husband's picture of me is complete now, and I'm pretty sure neither of us likes it much. I just want that feeling of not having gone wrong yet. And that's the feeling she has with her lover, because she's a kind of new book for him.
Yeah, that's right. And I think it's a very, very strong urge in all of us that, in a sense, it's not wanting to be known, isn't it?
Well, to tell all your great stories over again and have somebody be amazed at them because they've never heard them before.
That's right. And, I think if you've been in a relationship for any length of time, that feeling you have when you're telling stories to somebody else and your partner's sitting there and you think, Jesus, how many times has she heard this?
Right.
And it's depressing.
No, I know you've been asked this a lot, I'm sure, but whereas your other books have always been written from the man's point of view, this book about a couple is written from the wife's point of view. Why did you want to do it from her point of view?
Well, to begin with, it was a purely technical thing connected with the novel, which is that the thrust of the book is that her husband David, who's this grouchy, disappointed, permanently aggrieved, middle-aged man, he's in his 40s. He's got a bad back and he goes off to see a spiritual healer and comes back a completely different person. He's full of love and he wants to give away everything they own. And Katie, from having been the kind of moral conscience of the relationship, is suddenly on the moral back foot. Now, when I was conceiving the idea for the book, I knew that I wanted to write about a strained relationship that was put under more strain by somebody's spiritual conversion, and for the other partner to comment on it. And I have to say, rather sadly, that when I thought about this, it seemed more likely to me that it would be, first of all, the man that was permanently aggrieved and disappointed and angry, and also the man who would react more intemperately to some outside pressure. So that left me with the female as the narrator. But also, I really like writing in the first person, and there are two genders to choose from, and it seems crazy to limit yourself to one for the rest of your career.
Since your previous books have been from the male point of view, were the things that you had to see differently even about your own life when trying to examine them from a woman's point of view?
I think that the big challenge is the frame of reference, that whereas my automatic reaction to illustrate something would be to choose some kind of cultural metaphor, maybe from a place that Casey wouldn't have experienced. So it's rephrasing and reframing things that I think is the hardest thing to do. But generally, I do think that we're so much closer together, the genders, than we were. And I think there's a kind of extremism of masculinity, which involves, you know, shaved heads and thousands of pints of beer, and an extremism of femininity, which is sort of frilly pink things, and that most of us occupy a space somewhere in the middle and change over pretty frequently. So I didn't feel too kind of scared about creating the kind of woman that I wanted her to be.
Were there things you actually had to ask other women about in creating her and creating her voice?
Well, it was a very interesting experience to give a woman a novel and tell her it's narrated by a woman but written by a man, and then ask her to comment, because line by line, whoever you show it to is going to come up with some pretty interesting stuff. And it did occur to me after a while that, in fact, if it had been a woman that had written this book and with a female narrator, various friends would have come up with just as many points and said that they hadn't been convinced. You know, if I hadn't told them in the first place that it was a woman author. I think authenticity is always in question in fiction anyway. And there are all sorts of kind of odd moments. There's a reference to Lee Harvey Oswald on the very first page of the book, and one woman I know said she didn't think women would make political references of that kind. And I started to get kind of depressed about it around about that point, because it seemed so patronizing of their own sex. So I left it in there.
My guest is Nick Hornby. His new novel is called How to Be Good. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Nick Hornby, author of High Fidelity, Fever Pitch, About a Boy, and the new novel, How to Be Good. Last year, Hornby edited an anthology of short stories, with profits going to the special school that his autistic son attends. I asked him about that. Did your attempts to do good with that book figure into your writing of this book?
Since my son was diagnosed, I do think that my moral universe has become more complicated, I think, in ways that I hadn't expected it to be. For a start, I seem to deal with people who operate in a sphere of pure love and devotion. And, you know, I think, well, you probably know yourself, Terry, but when you work in the media and with books, and pure love and devotion quite often is in short supply. There's a lot of bitching and moaning. You know, I'm working with all these people who just have fantastic degree of patience and resilience in dealing with very difficult children. So I've been really kind of bowled over by them and felt almost inadequate in lots and lots of ways. And, you know, doing this book was easy and fun, and I was really proud of the book, but it still doesn't feel like a really big deal to do something like that.
Your main character, Katie, says that getting married and having a family is like emigrating to a different country. I'm wondering, though, if having like an autistic son made it more like emigrating to a different country, because so few people in your circle of friends, I'm sure, experienced anything like that.
Yeah, I think it is a great separation thing, that people don't really understand quite how different your experience of parenthood is, for example. You know, most of my friends have kids now, and they've always been incredibly sympathetic and respectful and so on, but they don't know what the day-to-day detail of dealing with Danny is. So you do tend to hang out with other people who are in the same situation.
What are some of the things that parents of children who aren't autistic would experience that you feel don't really apply to you?
Well, I guess, I mean, the basic thing is that everything's easier with kids who are not autistic, that it doesn't become such a big deal, you know, to go to visit somebody at their house, for example. I mean, Danny might just literally refuse to go indoors because he doesn't like the vibe, or there are other kids there and he's scared of other kids. And so, you know, visits of that kind can last anything from between, you know, 1 minute and 3 minutes, not usually much longer than that. But it's sort of, you know, most seconds of the day, things are different from the other experience, the normal experience.
Nick Hornby is my guest. He's the author of High Fidelity, Fever Pitch, and About a Boy. He has a new novel, which is called How to Be Good. When your novel High Fidelity was made into a movie, I think some of the records that the people in the record store talk about and buy, and some of the records that the main character is most obsessed with, are changed, in part because this setting is a few years later, and also the setting in the movie is America, whereas the setting in the novel is England. Did you help choose what the movies, what the records in the movie were going to be?
No, I didn't, and I'm kind of glad that I left it to them, because the guys who made the movie, John Cusack and the two co-writers, they're exactly the right age, and they're completely obsessed with music. I think DV, I may have read this somewhere, has 10 or 15,000 vinyl records and is constantly buying pieces of hi-fi equipment. And no, they're absolutely the right guys to choose it. And I think I wouldn't have got it right, either generationally or culturally. So I left it to them, and they did a pretty good job, I think.
Do you know if they had to change some of their choices because the rights for the music were too expensive? You have to buy the rights before you can use a record in a movie.
No, as I understand it, the only reason they ever changed their mind was because they kept changing their minds, like Rob in the book. I think I remember somebody saying that Disney had made more clearances for High Fidelity than for any other movie that they'd ever been involved in. And I think the music budget for High Fidelity was almost the same as the total budget for Fever Pitch. But they didn't suffer from that, at least.
Are you following soccer, football, as carefully as you used to?
Yeah, I follow it as carefully. I wouldn't say that I've felt quite the same way about it. I still live right next to the soccer stadium, so it actually doesn't take a big chunk out of the day or out of the week to go and see them. It really is walking around the corner. But the game has changed so much in the last few years, in England in particular, I think. And there are almost no English players, for example, who play for Arsenal anymore. It's become much more kind of mercenary, in that players come from France or Italy or Spain or Holland and stay a year and then start saying that they want to go and play somewhere else. And I think this is actually beginning to loosen the bond between fan and club.
You know, it's funny, in the movie A Fever Pitch, when the guy in the story is trying to convince his girlfriend or fiancé to get a home that's right a block away from the
yes.
soccer stadium, mm-hmm. I was thinking, you're crazy. Sure, it's going to be convenient to get there, but there's going to be mobs of people parading past your house all the time, and that's not going to be pleasant. So what is it like to have lots of you know, fans coming and going from the stadium, passing by your home?
Well, this is a subject of great debate among residents of the area. lots of them aren't very keen, and actually lots of them are. But generally speaking, I think people do quite like living on top of a football stadium. It's like waking up on a Saturday morning and having some kind of fun fair or something, right in your front yard. There's an atmosphere, there's a buzz. People are selling things from the wall outside your room. It's just much more interesting than most places, and I really enjoy it. And, you know, the game finishes at 5 o'clock and everyone's gone home by 5:45. It's not such a big deal.
Do people ever drink a lot of beer and urinate in front of your house?
That can happen, yeah.
Doesn't bother you?
I'll be honest about that.
You just take that in your stride?
Yeah, my stride sort of takes me over it, if you see what I mean.
Right. I think I got that cliche wrong. You take it in stride, not in your stride, right?
No, in your stride's
in your
good.
Stride?
But,
okay.
Yeah, but I'm saying I'm striding over it, so...
Okay. You've been writing music criticism for The New Yorker magazine. Do you enjoy writing about music, you know, functioning as a critic?
Yeah, I think it's incredibly hard. I think that writing about music is much, much harder than writing about books, where, if you're going to be lazy, you can always retell the plot or you've got some kind of take on the content. But to actually describe the way something sounds is tough, I think. And I think it's not something that you can do forever unless you're very, very resourceful. But I do enjoy it, and it's fantastic just being exposed to so much more music and music that I might not have heard otherwise.
Did you ever play an instrument or sing yourself?
I have done. I don't really want to be drawn on that. You can ask me about my parents' marriage and everything, but you're not going to talk to me about my harmonica playing, okay?
Is that because you don't think you're very good?
It's just a very personal thing.
Oh, fair enough.
You've gone way over the mark now.
I've crossed the line.
You've crossed the line. I'm going to walk out. My headphones are going to be thrown on the floor.
Well, I better quit while I'm ahead and thank you right here. Well, Nick Hornby, thanks so much. Good luck with
thank
the novel
you.
And the new
you.
Movie. And thank
thanks.
You. Nick Hornby's new novel is called How to Be Good, a movie adaptation of his novel about a boy finished shooting last week. It stars Hugh Grant and Toni Collette. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Here's Jack Black from the soundtrack of High Fidelity.
I've been really trying, baby, trying to hold on to this feeling for so long. And if you feel like I feel, sugar, come on.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Audi, presenting Audi Assured certified pre-owned cars, including the A4, A6, and A8 with quattro all-wheel drive. AudiUSA.com/pre-owned. And from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the new folk music of the 60s and the interconnecting stories of four key performers, Bob Dylan, Joan Baez, Mimi Farina, and Richard Farina. We talk with David Haydu about his new book, Positively Fourth Street. And Milo Miles reviews White African, the new CD by bluesman Otis Taylor.
You just want to be on the side that's winning. You know it's not like that. if you're so hurt, why then don't you show it? You say you've lost your faith, but that's not where it's at. You have no faith to lose, and you know it. Behind my back, I used to be among the crowd you're in with.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the new book, Positively Fourth Street, David Hadou tells the story of the 60s folk renaissance by telling the interconnected personal stories of four performers, Bob Dylan, Joan Baez, Mimi Baez Farinha, and Richard Farinha. Hadou is also the author of Lush Life, a biography of composer Billy Strayhorn. Bob Dylan and Joan Baez were at the forefront of the folk renaissance. Richard and Mimi Farinha were lesser known. Let's start with the Farinhas' recording, Pack Up Your Sorrows.
No use crying, talking to a stranger, naming the sorrow you've seen. Too many bad times, too many sad times, nobody knows what you mean. But if somehow you could pack up your sorrows and give them all to me, you would lose them. I know how to use them. Give them all to me. No use rambling, walking in the shadows, trailing a wandering star. No one beside you, no one to hide you, and nobody knows what you are. But if somehow you could pack up your sorrows and give them all to me, you would lose them. I know how to use them. Give them all to me.
Richard and Mimi Farinha recorded in 1965. Richard died in a motorcycle accident in 1966, coming home from a book signing, celebrating the publication of his first novel, Been Down So Long It Looks Like Up to Me. It was his wife Mimi's 21st birthday. I asked David Hadou to tell us more about the Farinhas.
Mimi was Joan's little sister, 4 years younger, also a guitarist and a singer, very talented guitarist, perhaps a better guitarist than Joan. Difference between them musically is that Mimi had marginal interest in being a public performer. Now, Richard Farinha, whom she married at a very tender age, was a colleague and competitor and friend of Dylan's, who was trying to do something similar to what Dylan ended up doing. In Richard's case, he was a writer, studied at Nabokov, at Cornell under Nabokov, was good friends with Thomas Pynchon in college, and set out to do a literature with a rock and roll sensibility, a little before Dylan set out to do rock and roll with a literary sensibility. And they all sort of came together in a sort of strange period in the 1960s.
How did Dylan and Joan Baez first meet, and at what point were they in their music careers when they did meet?
It's interesting and largely forgotten today that Joan was a huge star and an important cultural force when Bob was largely unknown. They met literally on 4th Street, which recurs repeatedly in my book, which is why I named it one of the reasons I named it positively 4th Street, at the hub of the folk scene, Gertie's Folk City, and Joan being very well regarded in visiting New York at the time, was asked to sing. Bob sought her out and followed her out to the curb of Gertie's Folk City as she was leaving with her little sister, by the way, and said, "Oh, you know, can I sing a song for you? I wrote. I'm writing songs now. I want to sing a song for you. I wrote." And he bent down on one knee outside of Gertie's Folk City, and he sang, "Hey, hey, Woody Guthrie, I wrote you a song." And Joan thought, well, that was very nice. Well, bye-bye, we really must be going now. And she wasn't terribly impressed. Bob also made kind of an unseemly overture toward Mimi, Joan's little sister, on the same occasion. And I think for complicity of reasons, she wasn't especially enamored of Bob originally. It was a little later when he started writing songs of social consciousness, and they were at a party together, and she heard him playing With God on Our Side for some friends, when she realized that he was something special. It was the depth and the originality of his early compositions. And she was quite early in recognizing that Dylan was doing something special.
What did Joan Baez do for Bob Dylan's career?
Joan Baez gave Bob Dylan his start. She gave him her audience. She transferred her fame to him. She brought him along on her early tours, unbilled and largely unknown, and turned over the stage for the second half of her shows to him. She would brought this unknown guy out, and you know, and she would have to lecture her audiences who didn't particularly like him at first. He was doing a very, very different kind of thing. His voice was considered strange at the time. He was writing a different kind of music. His guitar playing was unconventional. Audiences would talk and sometimes boo a little bit, and she would have to come out and lecture them and say, "Listen to him. He's doing something different. Give him a chance." And that was the beginning of Bob's national exposure.
And Joan Baez and Bob Dylan were lovers at the time?
They fell in love very soon after he came to California and started writing in her house. And it was a very complex relationship, and elementally flawed as a romance because of the clash of egos involved. Someone said that they broke up eventually because they couldn't decide whose last name to give the children. I mean, they were two very strong people, but deeply attracted to each other and respectful of each other's accomplishments.
Although Joan Baez introduced Bob Dylan to her audience when she was more famous than he was, he didn't return the favor when he became famous and toured England. She had hoped that he would introduce her to his audience, and that didn't happen. What was going on between the two of them then?
From a careerist or a business point of view, it might have been nice for Bob to invite Joan onto the stage. Her fame was beginning to wane. She was losing her audience. Bob's audience was growing. He was on the ascent. From a musical point of view, from a creative point of view, it made very little sense for the two of them to be together anymore. And Bob recognized that before Joan caught on. I mean, by 64, 65, Bob was no longer doing traditional folk music or music of social consciousness. He was writing in a pop vein, and he was writing very internal, probing and poetic music that was nothing like the increasingly political and sometimes strident music that Joan was doing at that time.
My guest is David Heydu, author of the new book Positively Fourth Street. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is David Heydu. He's the author of the new book, Positively Fourth Street, The Lives and Times of Joan Baez, Bob Dylan, Mimi Baez Farina, and Richard Farina. Let's bring Richard Farina into the picture. Farina and Dylan had several things in common. One of them was that they liked to tell fictional stories about their early life. Let's start with Dylan, whose story is more famous by now. But what are some of the stories that were untrue that he told people when he first arrived on the Greenwich Village music scene?
Practically everything Dylan said since high school was untrue. You know, he originally created a whole new persona for himself while he was still in high school. He created another character named Elston Gunn, who was a rock and roll piano player, and he dropped the name Bob Zimmerman then. Well, he was just a teenager, started wearing pink shirts and bow ties and wearing a leather jacket, and, you know, and you could see him kind of appropriating the pop culture sources around him. He took Gunn from Peter Gunn, right? And then when rock and roll started to wane in popularity in the late 50s and folk started to emerge as the new, smart, cool, hip music, the music that was happening, he dropped his first created persona and invented another one, Bob Dylan, this time based on another TV character, Matt Dillon from the Gunsmoke series. And he started telling stories that reinforced this new image, that he worked in a car, that he was a carnival barker, that he rode the rails, that he was an orphan, that he was part American Indian, that he had an uncle who was a professional gambler, and, you know, he's all kinds of fanciful tales that portrayed him as a mysterious figure of the road.
And what are some of the things Richard Farina said about his past that were untrue?
Well, if it's at all possible to imagine this, Richard Farina outclassed Dylan as a myth maker. He used to say that he ran guns for Castro in Cuba, that he was a member of he worked for the IRA, and he used to claim that he had to sleep with a loaded .45 under his pillow. He used to say that he couldn't fly because he had a metal plate in his head, and if he flew, his head might explode. But with Richard Farina, it was always an awareness that it was a grand charade and an invitation to join in and take part of it.
So what was Farina's real story?
Farina's real story is about as mundane as Bob Dylan's. He was born and raised in Brooklyn and attended Brooklyn Technical High School, was a star student, quite bright, nose to the grindstone. And it was at Cornell that he started becoming a bit of a Heathcliff character.
Richard Farina became lovers and then the husband of Mimi Baez, Joan's younger sister. And you seem to think that Farina maybe married her in part for musical reasons, too. That she was the sister of a famous woman. She sang and could help round out his performance. Am I giving an accurate interpretation of your reading of this?
Well, Richard was boundlessly ambitious. He was over-absorbed with Mimi's being a Baez and being part of the illustrious Baez family. After he and Mimi agreed to marry, he bumped into a Cornell former teacher of his from Cornell, the novelist Herbert Gold, at the American Express office in Paris, and he yelled across the room to Herb, "Hey, Herb, guess what? I'm going to marry Joan Baez's sister." Well, that said, although that was clearly a component of his attraction to Mimi, everyone who met Mimi Baez was attracted to Mimi Baez, not just physically, but she was a very warm and loving person and a bright person. When they did come together and develop a relationship, it became more than just kind of a simplistic, Machiavellian thing. It became largely, symbiotic, and she contributed mightily to his development as a musician. And if it weren't for Mimi and her knowledge of music theory and her understanding of chords and her own creativity, Richard Fregna would never have emerged as a half-decent songwriter as he did. He would never have had the moderately successful career as half of a performing folk duo that he did with Mimi.
Let's say something about the dynamic between this foursome when they were together. Joan Baez, Bob Dylan, Mimi Farina, and Richard Farina.
Yeah. The four of them came together quite a bit in California. They lived next to each other. And for a while, in 1964, they all lived together in a house for a summer. Thomas Pynchon said it certainly was a nest of vipers, wasn't it? It was a little bit more than that, but there was a lot of competitive inspiration as well as, you know, sheer rivalry. But Farina egged Dylan on as a writer. They were both in a race to complete their books. They both had intended to have their books published in 1966. And Mimi and Joan, like all sisters, were always intensely rivalrous. And the sexual dynamic of the four of them just made this horribly complicated. To make it as simple as I can, and it's not easy, Bob was always attracted to Mimi first. I mean, when Bob met Joan, it was in Mimi's company, and he always had a crush on Mimi. Richard seemed to have had his eye on Joan all along, and by 1965 had wormed his way into Joan's career and was producing a record for her and writing music for her and beginning to talk about a whole series of other projects with her.
Some of the research that you did for your new book is very interesting. For example, you communicated with the writer Thomas Pynchon, the reclusive writer who never talks to the press. He had been Richard Farina's college roommate at Cornell and best man at Farina's wedding with Mimi. How did you manage to talk with him? Or communicate with him might be the better word.
Thomas Pynchon was one of many people who Richard Farina influenced very deeply, and one of many people who considered Richard Farina his best friend. You know, it just says something about the kind of person Richard Farina was. I mean, a fount of ideas, full of life, inspired a number of people around him, including the other people who were the core subjects of my book. And he was best friends with Pynchon in college. Pynchon was the best man at Farina's wedding to Mimi, and then the pallbearer at Richard's funeral. I wish I had a colorful anecdote about, you know, Pynchon's coming out of, you know, seclusion to talk to me. It really had nothing to do with me, I'm convinced. I submitted some questions to him, you know, formally through his publisher, expected them to disappear into the ether, and was quite shocked when he responded by fax. And after that, there was some back and forth and exchange of some letters, and he couldn't have been more helpful. He answered everything I asked, was charming and illuminating. I'm convinced that Pynchon's affection for this person, Farina, and was such that he thought it important to help tell Farina's story. I think he thought that Farina's story is a story that needs to be told, and even if he had to, you know, come out of his hole to pitch in, well, it was worth doing.
I think people are pretty much able to keep up with what Bob Dylan has been doing musically, particularly because he had his 60th birthday recently. He was very much in the news. What about Joan Baez and Mimi Farina?
Mimi essentially gave up public performing about 30 years ago to shift her focus to public service, and she started an organization called Bread and Roses in the San Francisco Bay Area devoted to bringing music and other entertainment to shut-ins, hospital patients, prisoners, and such. And it's now an enormous organization, an influential one with branches all around the country. That's been Mimi's focus. She's very well known in social service circles around the country, entirely apart from her early work in music. And she's quite ill at the moment with cancer. And as a result, her big sister, Joan, has stopped touring for the foreseeable future to be at Mimi's side. In fact, the entire Baez family is at Mimi's side in Mill Valley while Mimi fights quite serious bout of cancer, with cancer.
Well, David Haydu, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you. I had a great time.
David Haydu is the author of Positively Fourth Street. Coming up, Milo Miles reviews a new CD by blues musician and singer Otis Taylor. This is Fresh Air. Otis Taylor formed his first blues band in 1964. By 1977, he quit the music business, then stayed away nearly 20 years. Music critic Milo Miles says in Taylor's new album, White African, he infuses his folk blues storytelling with vivid characters and a keen sense of social and music history.
Well, my soul, Louisiana, but my body lies in Tennessee. I didn't kill no brakeman. I didn't kill no engineer. Well, a white man pointed his finger and they said what they always say. They didn't bother to hang me. They just shot me on the spot.
Modern blues performers have an image problem. If they are too self-conscious and thoughtful, they seem like curators, preserving somebody else's blues. But if they make visceral music, the only popular styles nowadays are party guitar, boogie, or gangsta blues. Even perceptive performers like Alvin Youngblood Hart and Corey Harris have trouble keeping the tone of their music lively, but not lowlife. Now coming straight out of Colorado is Otis Taylor, whose album White African is the most on-target blues record I've heard in years. Taylor's music is electric without blaring. His songs are angry without craziness. They make you think, might make you flinch and sweat a little bit, too. Taylor is far from a newcomer. Born in 1948, he played in mostly obscure bands until 1977. Then he took an extended break from music until his 1996 solo debut, Blue-Eyed Monster. He followed up with When Negroes Walk the Earth. That CD is illustrated with photos of Otis Taylor's father from the 1940s, when Negroes indeed did walk the earth. That's just one example of Taylor's fine, caustic sense of history and its consequences. But White African is his most focused, ferocious collection of songs. Taylor's electric banjo and the lack of drums give his tunes some of the eerie tang of Blind Lemon Jefferson or John Lee Hooker. But stories always dominate. Taylor's soft voice is an advantage as he sings, whispers, or just talks his tormented characters to life. Here is a homeless father whose child is dying because he cannot pay for medical treatment.
I ain't slept. Three days and three nights. My little girl, my little girl, she's slipping away.
I said, don't worry, don't worry. If I fall asleep, oh, then Jesus, Jesus will hold your hand. Hold your hand, baby. I went to the hospital. Wow! I said the doc, I said the doctor wouldn't even let us in. I went back home to my cardboard box. Laid my little girl down. I said, don't worry, don't worry. Cause heaven would let us in.
Taylor can make fantastic states of mind seem like facts, and factual situations seem like nightmares. In the strange religious number, Resurrection Blues, he explains that while people understand they have to suffer before they die, they don't want to become Jesus.
Woke up this morning.
Harrowing track, St. Martha Blues, describes how Taylor's great-grandfather was lynched and dismembered, and how his great-grandmother persevered without hope for justice. Taylor has said he wants to say much with a minimum of words. He gets it here.
Poor, poor, poor Martha. She got to go. She got to go and find. She got to go and find. She got to go and find her husband. She walking all over town. She walking all over town. She's dragging. Oh, she's dragging that bag behind her. She got to go and find her husband. Oh, Martha. Paul St. Martha.
No one who hears Otis Taylor's White African should ever imagine that the blues have to be safe or brutal or antique.
Milo Miles is a music writer living in Cambridge. He reviewed White African by Otis Taylor on Northern Blues Music. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of A Traitor to Memory by Elizabeth George, author of In Pursuit of the Proper Sinner. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
When Roger Angel decided to write a book about Cy Young Award-winning pitcher David Cone, he expected it to be the story of an old master at his best. Instead, it's the chronicle of a pitcher's disastrous season. On the next Fresh Air, Angel talks about his new book, A Pitcher's Story. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.